welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston. My guest today is the head of the Electric Shadow Network of podcasts, where he hosts and masterminds a plethora of shows on a plethora of topics, ranging from comics to nerd culture, from women and minorities playing games to movies, from the freelance creator's working life to sex and sexuality. But he remains best known as the host of Giant Size, a show all about comics and the various ways we read and consume them, which is a nice coincidence, given what he's come on here to talk about today. So welcome back to the show, Moises Chuyan.
Thanks so much, Anthony. Am I the first return guest?
Yes, you are. You are the first person back. You were on episode 3, your first appearance, I believe, so very early on. And yes, you are, I'm pretty sure, the first returning guest in the schedule.
Well, I'm worried that that this return appearance is going to scuttle all of my credibility. It's going to bring into question any faith that anyone may want to put into me blindly. It's been so long since I've been on the show. Do I drop the bomb of what this alleged rotten egg is that I have a certain amount of appreciation for?
You do indeed have that honor. So tell us what you've come on to talk about. Give us some context around it, its release, its reception upon release, why it's maligned, and why you think that that is wrong.
I have a certain amount of affection for. I would not go so far as to say that I love, as is in the intro that we all know and love in Unjustly Maligned, Frank Miller's collaboration with Lynn Varley from 2001 and 2002, The Dark Knight Strikes Again, the sequel to the legendary Dark Knight Returns miniseries from the late 80s. I think that if there is something that is most maligned for, people find the difference in art style from its predecessor jarring. They find the focus of the story jarring. More than anything, it seems that the greatest issue that that fans who love to hate on this have is that The Dark Knight Strikes Again is not quite precisely exactly the same as The Dark Knight Returns as they would like. They would like something that was much more in tone, in focus, in scope of story, much more like that rather than a continuation of that universe. And there are a number of elements in particular that were prescient before the age of YouTube, before the age of social media, before the age of various things that were on their way toward crumbling, but were not quite there in December of 2001 when the miniseries started running, that in retrospect, I think if people went back and read this, they would find much easier to comprehend or much quicker to appreciate than maybe they did at the time when generalized internet communication was something that people were just really getting comfortable with as a regular part of life. Not everyone had cell phones. Smartphones didn't exist. It's something that is very much a product of its time, but contextually, if you're not reading it, keeping in mind when it came out and what it came before, it's almost a totally different work in some ways. Now there are parts of it that I'm not terribly thrilled with. So that's where I don't have an unqualified rave of it. But there are elements of it that I find very interesting, and it's something that, you know, I don't know what to expect out of Dark Knight 3, The Master Race, but there are elements in Dark Knight 2 that make me feel like it's worth actually giving Dark Knight 3 a chance. Because as much as people like to malign Miller himself, whether for political beliefs, which, by the way, I don't share, or later works like All-Star Batman and Robin and Holy Terror, I prefer to look at his entire body of work in terms of appreciating Miller and thinking about Miller, even politically. Believe it or not, people like to classify him as some sort of ultra right wing crypto fascist, and I don't even know that Dark Knight Strikes Again really hits many of those notes. And if anything, is very anti-Republican, anti-right-wing, in many of the same ways that The Dark Knight Returns is. So that long, rambling stream of consciousness, assemblage of thoughts, hopefully encapsulates a good chunk of what we'll get into, and also is evocative of The Dark Knight Strikes Again as well. One of the things that people hate about it. You know, what? Wait a minute, where are we now? Why are we jumping to this?
Right, it does jump around all over the place, yeah. I mean, just sort of briefly, as an aside, I don't want to get too much into Miller's politics because it's not something that he really speaks about a great deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, a man's politics are his own. But I think if we assume that the attitudes espoused in this book, you know, which are seen to be sort of, you know, the right attitudes, reflect Miller's own political beliefs, I think it's probably fair to say that he's not really anti-left or right. He's more just sort of anti-politicians. You know, a libertarian in the sort of quite old-fashioned sense, because he certainly doesn't seem to have any love for either side of the political class.
Yeah, so, you know, the sort of corporate interests enslaving one's government and then one's government thereby enslaving the populace is something that I think is a common thread in a lot of apolitical superhero stories.
Right.
You know, people becoming vigilantes to stand up for what's right.
Well, and a lot of Miller's work.
And a lot of Miller's stuff, yeah. Too. Yeah.
Yeah. It is a theme that runs throughout his whole body of work. And you mentioned that. And I think that's an important thing to say as well. Like, you know, people will know I'm not the biggest fan of superheroes in general, but I do enjoy the classics. I think Dark Knight Returns is a classic. You know, I enjoy Year One as well, actually, and, you know, others besides, yeah. Like, obviously, you know, things like Watchmen and V for Vendetta, which is a superhero story, really, and blah, blah.
And you wrote Daredevil, and anybody I know who's written Daredevil doesn't have at least a little bit of an appreciation for Miller's Born Again run.
Exactly.
On Daredevil.
Exactly. You know, it's modern day Daredevil would not be as we know him without Miller's contribution. So it is important to say at the outset, especially for me being somebody who's in the industry, like, I have an enormous amount of respect for Frank Miller. And, you know, the man's contribution to the American comics industry and comics as a medium can hardly be overestimated. It is enormous. And, you know, what have you done lately? You know what I mean? you can't take that away from him. He has been more influential than probably 99% of all people who have worked in the industry. You know, there are a handful, maybe two handfuls of people that you can sort of name as being, having as much influence or more than Miller. Really not many at all. So I just want to sort of make that clear. I have an enormous amount of respect for Miller and for his work. Not a huge fan of this book, though, I must say. And
yeah, my relationship with it is this weird, conflicted thing where, going with the general theme of the show, I think it is unjustly maligned in a variety of ways. I think there are a variety of ways in which it is very justly maligned and not the sort of thing that I think, you know, that's something that I want to pull off the shelf and read on a lazy Saturday night.
Right.
But there are elements of it that I think go completely unappreciated whatsoever. In a mad dash to find a reason to tear down the legacy of a creator whose body of work is very much of the, well, what have you done lately, yeah, to say this about this person,
well,
sort of variety.
And I think there are also elements that are very much maligned incorrectly, you know, sort of literally unjustly. It's not just that they're unappreciated, but that there are some things where I just plain disagree with some of the criticisms. I mean, like I say, I'm not a huge fan of this book, but I do think it is unjustly maligned. Here's a thing for you. I'd never read it.
And I find that a lot of people haven't, who say, oh, well, Dark Knight Strikes Again. Well, you know, Dark Knight Strikes,
right,
Again. Yeah, what do you not like about it? Well, I mean, everything, basically. Well, what specifically? Did you have the same kind of problems with the art that some people did in this one part? Well, I didn't actually read it,
exactly,
when it really comes down to it. That's what I found time after time after time when I try to have a conversation with people about this. Not sticking up for it is something that I even necessarily love, but something that I just want to have an analytical conversation with someone about.
Just on principle, yeah.
Just on principle, and people just haven't read it, and they assume that they dislike it. It's like movies like John Carter of Mars, released as John Carter, that people just assume that they hate because it was a big flop or it was critically maligned. and they just never saw it. And so they malign it by proxy.
Yep. I talked about this on a recent episode with Danielle Henderson, actually, talking about the sort of how the same, it's sometimes a hive mind of criticism develops around a thing where it almost feels like, you know, and not saying that there is an actual cabal, but it feels like you could be forgiven for thinking that there is some kind of, that all the critics get together in a big conclave and agree that they're going to hate something and tell everybody it's worthless. And so nobody, you know, consumes it. Nobody gets to see it or reads it or whatever, because every critic is telling them that it's a waste of time and terrible and it's going to be a flop. And so it becomes self-perpetuating. Now, Dark Knight Strikes Again wasn't a flop in commercial terms. Because I think, if nothing else, just because Batman is such a huge thing, Miller's name and the sort of brand of his name is such a huge thing, that it was never going to be a commercial failure.
Well, the 15-year anticipation for, oh, well, this is going to be the big follow-up.
Exactly. But I had heard such crazy bad things about it at the time. And I do, as I say, I like Dark Knight Returns, and I actually like Year One probably better than Dark Knight Returns. I think Year One is an amazing sort of self-contained origin story, if you like, so well told. But I am just not a huge Batman guy, not a huge superhero guy in general. So I didn't feel the need to read something that I felt like I'd sort of heard all sides of criticism of. Do you know what I mean? Especially at the time. I mean, as you say, it was published 2001, 15 years after Dark Knight Returns.
December of 2001,
right.
Just on the heels of the September 11th terrorist attack.
Right, which shows through. And I remember reading at the time
massively
that there were some changes made to it in light of the attacks. And now, of course, 14 years on from that, now we get Dark Knight 3 with an almost entirely different creative team. Miller's the only sort of member of the creative team left, if you like. So there's so much wrapped up in this with regards to its sort of its general perception amongst critics and people who have read it, and that filtered out so much into the wider comics culture and wider comics opinion that, yeah, as you say, it started to feel like you didn't need to read it to know it was bad.
People cited this when Before Watchmen got announced as, oh, well, we're going to do this again.
Right,
fantastic.
Right.
We saw how well that went the first time. And again, a lot of these people didn't even read it in the first place, but it became emblematic of, do we really need to bleed this stone anymore? Do we really need to go back to the well? I'm trying to think of other tired metaphors that I can cite. you contextualized your Batman and superhero preferences, and you know, people who listen to your show may not listen to any of the stuff that I do, and this may be the first time they hear me talking about anything because they're thinking, "Who is this lunatic who likes this?" My relationship with Batman is such that I grew up enjoying the 1960s television series as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Found it really entertaining. When I got into high school, I became absolutely devoted to the then current run being spearheaded by Greg Rucka, which was very much more in the Dark Knight detective kind of mold, and was during the era of the Cataclysm storyline that was strip mined for the Dark Knight Rises movie. You know, for those who know Batman canon much better by what gets ripped out and put into live action movies. And I enjoy the character. I'm not a Batman obsessive, like I think a lot of people are. I think a lot of people identify as that being one of their core fandoms, and it's something that they get tattooed on their bodies and is a deep, 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 big deal part of their lives. That isn't to say that I haven't read a gigantic amount of Batman stuff, because at some points in DC's publishing history, most of what they've published has been Batman stuff.
Oh, yes.
In some respect or another. But for me, the thing that I liked most about The Dark Knight Returns when I first read it was that it was part of a greater initiative that no longer technically exists at DC, but they sort of kind of have kind of dipped back into it because, of course, they're doing another Dark Knight series. It was considered under their Elseworlds banner, something that with the new 52, they said, nope, no more Elseworlds. And these are side alternate universe stories that, if you're using the Marvel parlance, come under the, well, what if, you know, what if, let's say, for example, Jane Foster became Thor, Wouldn't that be crazy? Wouldn't that be insane? Wouldn't that be weird? Marvel would do these single one-off issues, and DC, especially in the area of the 80s and 90s, would do these perfect bound, sometimes just plain one shot. In some cases, Dark Knight Returns actually being, I want to say, one of the first, if not the first.
I don't think Dark Knight Returns was officially an Elseworlds.
It wasn't officially. It was retroactively cobbled under that banner. It was considered as happening on an alternate Earth in an alternate timeline with, you know, obviously lots of different things happening. And now I think at least before Flashpoint, before the New 52, before all that stuff, they officially adopted it as Earth 31 or 30 something or another. So it's something that when I read it, the actual Elseworlds line was a thing, and there were things like Gotham by Gaslight and Speeding Bullets, where let's say, for example, this orphan from Krypton landed not in Kansas, but in Gotham, and was raised by a couple named Thomas and Martha Wayne and given the name Bruce. And, you know, what if Kal-El had been raised as Bruce Wayne? You know, there were these cool alternate reality sorts of things that I had read before or near the time that I read Dark Knight Returns. And I dug that stuff. I still dig that stuff. It's something that I don't see why publishers should run away from it, because that's the kind of stuff that you would argue about with your friends in the schoolyard. And I think arguably that aspect of it, of the core story of the original Dark Knight Returns, is what made it so popular. It was the, wow, what if all of this stuff happened? What if, you know, Batman had a friggin' tank and there were these mutant gangs like there are in the Ninja Turtles movie? And it was bloody and gritty and crazy, man. It's the weirdest, craziest Batman thing ever. And that's just something that I thought was neat. It's not something that I think all Batman should be. And that's the only thing that I want Batman should be to be in all forms of media. And the repeated citing of, well, we really like Dark Knight Returns, whenever they're going to do a new Batman movie, a new Batman and Superman movie, it's something that it seems like four or five movies on now, it gets repeatedly cited as, well, we sure like that Dark Knight Returns. Mm-hmm. We're looking to bring a lot of that Dark Knight Returns juice to this thing. I kind of get tired of it.
Well, and talking about Elseworlds, I think Elseworlds actually was killed long before the New 52, if I recall correctly, as a sort of, as an official brand. For one thing, this is, God, you make me feel old. I was, Elseworlds was like just getting started when I was in high school. I read Dark Knight Returns in high school, like a couple of years after it had been first published. But one of the things that I saw, actually, and, you know, I don't just say that to sort of moan how old I am, but also to point out that one of the things I saw at the time was that there were a lot of people who would not pick up a regular Batman comic. And probably wouldn't even pick up a regular Batman trade. There's no way these people were going to pick up, you know, a Batmite adventure or something. But they would pick up the Elseworlds because they looked different. They often had, you know, sort of non-traditional art styles, but also because they were the what ifs. And I think that really helped mainstream, and by that I mean real mainstream readers. It gave them an entry point. It gave them a way of saying, this is just one story. It's not even real Batman, but it's an interesting idea. And I only have to read this one story, and I don't need to know anything that happened before or worry about picking up another 10 books afterwards. I can just read this one story. Something like Gotham by Gaslight, the Mike Mignola Elseworlds being a great example of that. That, I recall, was one of the best of the original Elseworlds line. I loved that book. So I think that was a mistake to get rid of that. And I think a lot of that attitude is what led to Dark Knight Returns' success. It was, as you say, a giant what if, and that attracted a lot of mainstream readers to go like, wow, what if Batman was 60 years old and he'd retired? And like, oh my God, what a crazy concept. The problem, I think, faced by many people, I mean, certainly by Miller with Dark Knight Strikes Again, and by pretty much anybody now as well, is that we've had Dark Knight Returns, we've had Watchmen. The idea of superheroes getting old or coming out of retirement or going into retirement or being legislated against by the government is now passé. We are 30 years on from when that idea first surfaced, you know? It has become a part of the mainstream lexicon. It is not an edgy, unusual, unexpected, crazy idea anymore. It's just part of what you do with superheroes now. It has become part of the mainstream, part of the superhero mainstream.
Yeah, it's a what else you got kind of a thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, well, as you say, like all these people going back to the well of Dark Knight Returns. It's like, really, guys? Really? 30 years old? Can you not find something else in this, you know, character's universe to draw on?
Yeah, and they don't even realize that they're lifting from Sudden Impact, which Miller was very directly influenced by for Dark Knight Returns, more than they're catching some of that Dark right. Knight lightning, and they're going to be the next Frank Miller or something like that. You know, come on, guys. You know, go look at what this guy was dipping his quill pen into.
Right, look at all the manga influences that Miller took for
exactly. I mean, from this point, of course, if you haven't read The Dark Knight Returns or watched the animated movie, which is surprisingly faithful to the original comics.
Oh, I haven't seen that. Is it?
It's very, very, very faithful. And they released it in two parts because I think they had a runtime limit. Where they couldn't do the whole thing in one go, so they split it into two parts, and then they later released a deluxe edition that you can get on digital download services, on Blu-ray, that's the whole thing cut together as just one movie, with Peter Weller playing Batman, Arielle Winter as Carrie Kelly, and Michael Emerson, is that the guy's name from Lost, and he plays the Joker.
Really? Oh wow!
Yeah, he's as many different guys as have played the Joker, in addition to Mark Hamill,
of course.
The legendary, the one true Joker, to a lot of us. He really has this particularly kind of vacant, haunting sound that he gives to the voice one of the great among many Joker stories.
Peter Weller playing Batman and Michael Emerson playing the Joker. I can't believe that somebody didn't tell me about that before. Now I really have to go and watch this.
I'm aghast, actually, at myself, at my own dereliction of duty in this respect.
All right, so let's move on and talk more specifically about Dark Knight Strikes Again. We've said that it was published 15 years after the original, which may or may not be a mistake, whatever. You know, maybe it should have been done 3 years after the original. But then it would have been a very different book, because it is, as you say, very much a book of its time. And part of that is, I think you can see, because in between doing Dark Knight Returns and Dark Knight Strikes Again, or DK2, as it was flippantly known, Miller had done like a massive amount of Sin City work. And had spent most of his time basically working on Sin City and 300 books, focusing on his own work, on original work, on creator-owned work, doing whatever the hell he wanted, having enormous success doing it, and notably not doing superhero work. So I think all of that had to have colored his attitude when he then came back to do Dark Knight Strikes Again. Whether that was, and I don't actually know the inside baseball on whether he pitched it or whether it was because I know Bob Schreck had recently left Oni to go and join DC, and maybe Bob persuaded him to come back and do it. I'm not actually sure what the reality of that is, but either way, coming back after such a long time away from the very distinct and unique, I mean, like, you know, people who aren't that familiar with comics may not realize just how different the mainstream superhero stuff is to pretty much everything else in American comics.
It's a very strange time in particular. One of the things that we recently this year that we did on Giant Size was maybe foolishly went through all of the major two publisher crossovers in what turned out to be a bazillion episode long string of torture, not unlike the Bataan Death March.
That was sort of crazy noble endeavor, it must be said.
I don't know how we survived, but when we got to this particular era, just following the 90s boom and bust of mainstream comics, where everything was covered in holofoil and everything had 11 variants, mm-hmm. and you know, the comics industry did itself in on a speculator boom. this coming after that was a, all right, well, I took it as something that I feel like Miller maybe had something new to say as time had gone on, and not necessarily saying that Dark Knight Strikes Again has something allegorically to say about the comics industry itself, but the transformation of superhero comics over that time is something that I feel like there might have been a creative urge separate from the kinds of personnel changes that you and I both know are, you know, that's something that can directly influence, you know, all of a sudden, you know, Mike Carlin was editing comics, and then all of a sudden he was executive producing a bunch of animated features and, you know, at a different publisher, and just, you know, somebody and the people that they like to work with going from one camp to another can completely shift the direction of where somebody's work is going.
Yes.
And as deeply affiliated with the Dark Knight Returns brand as Miller was, you know, I almost feel like looking back at the original, it's something that he didn't necessarily give himself an out at the end of Dark Knight Returns to go, you know, I could come back to this later, but he didn't seem, with the original work, really concerned with making sure that there was a complete finality to it. It seemed like it was something that he intentionally made so that it could stand on its own, and made it so that it's something that if he wanted to come back and play in that sandbox again, that he could.
You may be right, but I've always read it more as, and especially having now read Dark Knight Strikes Again, more as the Miller. I mean, bearing in mind also that obviously at the time, nobody had any idea that Dark Knight Returns was going to be the enormous success and massive influence on the rest of the industry that it became. Same as when Alan was writing Watchmen. He had no idea that this would become, you know, one of the canonical works of the medium. They were just writing a book. But the Miller who did Dark Knight Returns, and this is all speculation on my part, but I kind of feel throughout that he wanted to end it on a note of hope. Because the last few pages of Dark Knight Returns are quite hopeful and, you know, quite sort of forward-looking and like, okay, we have to do things differently now, but it's still going to be good. Everything's going to be okay. Whereas that's very much not the attitude prevalent in Dark Knight Strikes Again, which is a really, really cynical, satirical work.
Yeah, it's very much a, you know, let's ride this train down into the ravine and blow up the bridge. Mm.
Let's follow this through to its logical conclusion, and by the way, the worst logical conclusion.
Yes, with as much stuff destroyed, with the worst case scenario very much in mind, and Dark Knight Strikes Again, much more so than in 1986, he could have, you know, thought, well, let me leave this, you know, theoretically open-ended so that I could come back to it. I probably phrased that poorly, but it was more to me that it felt like in the construction of the original, he was setting it up so that the end of the story was the sort of thing that didn't have the kind of finality that Dark Knight Strikes Again has,
right?
To an extent, which I'll come back to again, but really, you know, it feels like there's somewhere to go with that reality that there is something in the reader's imagination that they can imagine, you know, in all of our million different imaginations, we can imagine the million different ways that world could continue on, which is just good storytelling. And I feel like there was much more of an intent at the end of Dark Knight Strikes Again to, because it just kind of ends, that's one of the criticisms that a lot of people, myself included, kind of throw at it, which is, that's it. That's an interesting panel to end it on. Timing wise, are we going to get another one in 3 years or something?
Right.
It very much feels like, well, when's the next one? It doesn't feel it's open ended to, I guess, technically, like the original is. In that, you know, this world goes on and, you know, this universe isn't destroyed or something. But this DK2 volume is very much more, leaving loose threads hanging. closing some loops in some places, but very, very much laying the groundwork for really absolutely blowing everything up.
Well, and I think part of that is because he brings so much of the rest of the DC universe into Dark Knight Strikes Again as well. I mean, yeah. Much as Dark Knight Returns may have been sort of technically an Elseworlds, he does bring some elements of, you know, the DC universe, mostly Gotham-related ones, obviously, into Dark Knight Returns, but not a huge amount. You know, you've got Batman, you've got, and Batman's villains, obviously, you've got Superman, you've got Green Arrow. Well, there's not a lot else. You know, there's not a lot else from the rest of the DC universe, whereas Dark Knight Strikes Again feels like he's cramming in as much of the DCU into this crazy, you know, Technicolor version of the Batman world as he possibly can. And I think, yeah. And, you know, spoiler alert, some of them get killed off. But I think that may be what feels like it's sort of, it needs a sequel almost, because it suddenly feels like the world has expanded beyond the confines of what it was in Dark Knight Returns.
I don't want to presume what he did and did not read and what he, you know, was and was not influenced by, but this came after Kingdom Come.
Yes.
And the kinds of DC universe wide stuff that they played with in that book, it almost to me felt like the spread with Dark Knight Strikes Again came off to me at the time as very much like, oh, okay, well, you're going to play with all the toys in the toy box. I'm going to go pull out some of my favorites too.
Right.
And I'm going to do this with the Atom, and I'm going to do this with the Elongated Man. And guess what? I'm also use Plastic Man, because, you know, who can use the Elongated Man and Plastic Man and do it well? Me.
I was very confused by that, because I'm not a big sort of DC, you know, wider DCU guy. And I was like, I assumed that Elongated Man was Plastic Man. Then I'm like, wait, hang on a second, there's two of them? What?
So the thing that I think I have trouble with as Dark Knight Strikes Again goes on is kind of trying to tell too many stories all at the same time in, I guess, too compact of a span, you know, not going to a fourth issue or a fifth issue.
Right. It's not even as long as Dark Knight Returns, is it?
No. So you've got this subplot with, and you know, from this point, we're going to spoil the whole thing, I guess.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You've got Dick Grayson, the fallen from grace Robin, done up as a new Joker. You've got the closing the loop on Luthor. You've got closing the loop on Brainiac. At the end of the story and at the beginning of the story, I feel like Dark Knight Strikes Again is almost more a prominent Superman story than a prominent Batman story.
Mm.
Batman doesn't show up for a lot.
For
a long time at the beginning. And I, you know, we could probably bring it down to metrics. I think there is more Superman in this than there is Batman. And from what's been teased, it seems like that is the plan for Dark Knight 3, that there's a very prominent role for Superman. And especially with the original title being Superman and Batman versus the Master Race. So it feels like in extending his story that he wants to tell in this universe, he has a lot of different threads that he wants to pick up. Dark Knight Strikes Again got greenlit for 3 issues, and he maybe had 6 or, like Dark Knight 3, 8 issues worth of stuff that he could have gotten into, wanted to get into, and just figured out a way to cram it into 3 around 80-ish page perfect bound volumes. And that kind of spread is something that I think affects one's enjoyment of it toward the end, where you're like, oh, so this is popping up and this is going to get crammed in. How many pages are left?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That is definitely something that it has going against it.
Well, and especially with Miller's sort of decompressed style of storytelling, and I hesitate to use that word because it gets bandied around a lot, but he was one of the first guys to really do that in Western comics, and as evidenced in Dark Knight Returns. And he uses it a lot here in Dark Knight Strikes Again to great effect. I mean, one of the things that I was pleasantly surprised by, actually, was that, you know, his page layouts and his sense of design are absolutely at the fore in this book. But they take up space. It uses pages. And so, as you say, when you're trying to cram so much story in, and then suddenly you've got these, you know, gorgeous layouts, but that only tell like a single moment in a story, it means that everything else has to then be sort of rushed and, as you say, crammed in.
It's something that if you don't, you have to start to ramp up the pace at which you're reading it, is something that I found in rereading it the other day in preparation for this, or you're not going to have a very good time with it. Mm. Because if you're not reading it at a pretty good clip as it progresses along, it just gets to be a bit much. And once you're kind of accustomed to, you know, the tiny postage stamp size of some of these panels that are in here, kind of guiding you to, you can blaze through this. You don't really need to like super read this one tiny little panel that some random talking head is just saying. It's kind of decompressed storytelling to me is one thing. And it's something that I tend to associate with, in six issues of a comic, I get what I feel like I used to get in one issue origin stories introducing a hero.
Right. And that's the bad side of decompression.
And for me, what Miller does, I would almost use a different term for it, to distance it from that, because that's its own enormous pocket industry of its own. But he has this kind of multi-threaded montage style of storytelling where he has a few concentrated threads and he explodes them all over each other. And those amazing layouts, those amazing designs are something that you can't exactly read something like Dark Knight Strikes Again the same pretty straightforward way that you would read something that's more composed on a pretty standard grid in terms of panel layout. You have to be ready to kind of breeze past certain things and almost see it in your mind's eye like those montages that you get in movies where there are different talking heads and it doesn't matter who it is. You're not paying attention to the actor that's playing it. Sometimes you don't even see their face. You just hear them narrating.
You're getting the overall gist.
Right. You're getting a cinematic kind of an effect from just the overload of information. And it's something that can be really overwhelming. It can be the sort of thing that I think is part of the reason that people who did actually read this found it just like way too much noise in the pre-social media.
Right. The information overload thing. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we had the information superhighway, a term that he actually uses in the book.
Yes, he does.
You know, we had a lot of people that were on the internet and using ICQ and AOL Instant Messenger and AOL message boards and news groups.
CompuServe. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. He does use those sort of montage layouts and stuff a lot. I mean, he did kind of do that a bit in Dark Knight Returns, but it is really, like everything else in this book, it is really ramped up to 11 in Dark Knight Strikes Again. But one of the things I wanted to say was that I thought they were really effective. One of the things I liked about this was that Miller had not lost his touch for building anticipation. Like, one of the things, from a storytelling point of view, from a pure craft point of view, one of the things I like about Dark Knight Returns so much is that first chapter, the first volume, is just builds anticipation so amazingly well that when you finally get the reveal of Batman in costume, it is glorious. You get the same thing here. He has not lost his touch for that. He builds the anticipation, all those little threads and the shots of Batman in shadow, Superman realizing something is coming, almost as a kind of, while he's saving the world 10 times over, almost as an afterthought, you know, his mind is actually on what on earth Bruce is up to now. It all works so well to build that anticipation and to make you want to keep turning the pages to get to, you know, the money shot, if you like, that you know is coming. It has to come of Batman on the page. And yet he does that so, so well in a very different way to Dark Knight Returns, because he does really cram in all this montage stuff, but it is so effective.
Yeah. The effect for me that it has looking at it now in the social media age that people don't appreciate is that all the, you know, YouTube stars didn't exist. YouTube didn't exist. But you read it now, and I don't want to give him credit for predicting something that I don't think he was trying to predict necessarily, because it seemed to be very much in the against the backdrop of cable news, There are a lot of cable news figures that you would still recognize that are visibly intentionally being parodied in some cases. But the rise of, in particular, this group of women wearing superhero costumes branded the Super Chicks, and lots of .coms being thrown around and that sort of thing. It's not explicit. I don't know if it's kind of casting them streaming on, you know, on an arcane version of what we now know as the YouTube web,
right?
And being competing noise with the traditional media pundits, the people we're used to. It's something that reads much more effectively for me now, 14 years later, right, than it did in 2001, where I was kind of like, wait, what is, huh? I don't get how any of this works.
I think that's a sort of a double-edged blade, really, because you, on the one hand, you're absolutely right, and you also have lines like, once your thoughts are committed to disc, the tyrants have them. And how prescient that turned out to be, you know?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you also have things like, the president of the USA is a computer-generated image. Oh my God, what's happening? And it's like, oh, you know, you couldn't rein yourself in, you know? You had to go just that little bit too far.
It's something that goes more cartoonish than I think a lot of people would expect.
Yes.
For something that's associated with the grim, gritty, and grounded, yes, Batman stories. That it's so real, and it goes so hard in the other direction. I can see how that's tremendously jarring. But again, in retrospect, you commit something to disc and they have it forever. There are things in this that were not going off of something that he was directly seeing happening, but that he was actively predicting, look, a version of this, it might not be called this, it might not be look like this. I'm not going to use specific phrases or terms for things like this, but I'm going to use enough identifiers that it's probably going to make sense 20 years from now, because people are still reading the thing that I did almost 20 years ago and citing it, and that's probably going to happen with this thing too. So,
oh, you think maybe he deliberately sort of created this with the knowledge that people would, like Dark Knight Returns, be looking at it in 10, 15 years' time?
I absolutely do. I think he was absolutely looking at this as him predicting, you know, the next me generation that we're living in now. And it's something that, maybe you're a big fan of these self-styled, upspeaking, quote-unquote comedians who know who their audience is. They know what the eyeballs they're getting are coming from. There's this woman who does like the nude news in Dark Knight Strikes Again. And there are countless examples of YouTube stars whose names I don't know, that have slipped my mind, that, you know, have millions and millions and millions of views on videos that they do to be intentionally provocative. I should, for people who don't know me, or this is their first look at me, you know, I'm not saying that all women on the internet are out for attention or that sort of a thing. I'm the kind of person who, you know, when you look at something like the Gamergate scandal and everything, I'm thrilled that Scarlett Johansson's looking at starring in a movie,
right, yeah,
about one of these women who was absolutely victimized and not asking for it. And, who, when her critics will go to her and say, well, why don't you just log off the net and go out into the real world? Well, that was the problem. She couldn't go out into the real world. I don't think that universally that is something that women on the internet are trying to do across the board, but there definitely is a subset of people whose lives are lived to become these sorts of hyper reality TV celebrities. And that's the basis of their fame and the basis of their business model and the basis of what gets them the hits and the eyeballs and the attention that puts them over the top and earns them a very healthy living, being the focus of everyone's internet voyeur attention. And I mean, at the time Dark Knight Strikes Again was out, I want to say this was still during the Jenny Cam era. Would you say that timing-wise, that's probably about right?
Probably, yeah, yeah,
It's round about there, because people take so many things for granted. They just take for granted the easy accessibility of uploading whatever video you want, for it not costing you anything. And I want to say that people originally reading this in 2001 were like, in what the hell? How does this work? I don't get this.
Well, I remember when Warren Ellis was doing things like the Citizen Journalist live feeds in Transmetropolitan, and everybody was like, what a crazy sci-fi idea. Yeah. And, you know, and now that's Periscope.
Exactly. And I, you know, God, if I couldn't love you enough already, Anthony, bringing up Transmetropolitan, that to me is a direct analog for, look, if you hated Dark Knight Strikes Again when you read it in 2001, maybe try reading it again over a decade later and seeing if you scan it differently.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think there were some evolving coming media trends that people just were not prepared for at the time, no matter how you slice it.
One of the things you mentioned about the storytelling was how overwhelming the effect is, which it absolutely is. But I think a large part of that as well is down to the colouring. We haven't mentioned Lynn Varley yet, who, you know, people with knowledge of comics will know was Frank Miller's wife for many years, colored pretty much all of his major work. Excellent veteran colorist, award-winning colorist, and came in actually for a lot of criticism on this book. I think it might have been one of her first major works with digital color, and a lot of people sort of leapt on that and assumed that therefore it was bad because she didn't know how to use computers, which, I mean, is just absurd, but it is very... It's a garish palette. So what do you think of that?
It was the Paleolithic age of digital coloring as we now know it. It really, really was, to the point that many things that were released around this time, you go on Marvel Unlimited and you look at some of their mainstream Marvel books that are on that service. And the best version of it that they have is scanned from a paper print copy printed on non-gloss, lower quality paper. You know, from the 2000s, from 2000, 2001, mm-hmm. that just does not look so great. Has a lot of gradients, has a lot of very lots questionable of choices, lots and lots of gradients. Boy, if you love gradients in your digital coloring, you have come to the right place. And it's something that I, you know, in retrospect, I appreciate and like it as an artifact of its time of being down to the coloring. A piece of comic art that is hopelessly stranded in this wasteland between, you know, the non-computerized coloring age and the super sophisticated, you know, if Lynn Varley had the tablet tools and software tools that are available today, boy, I bet this would look totally different.
Well, but I'm not so sure it would, because as you look at it, if you look more closely at the colors, you'll see... She clearly is in control of things like, you know, gradients and soft brushes and stuff like that. But she is also, yes, using hard lines and hard cuts and pixelating backgrounds and, you know, using sort of deliberately effects that look deliberately digital, that draw attention to the fact that this was generated on a computer. But in other places, not at all. In other places, it looks much more like what we now think of as traditional computer coloring. So like I say, there was a lot of criticism about this at the time. I remember it. And I having now read it, I find it quite hard to agree in retrospect. Maybe at the time I would have agreed, but looking back, I'm like, actually, no, I think a lot of this is quite deliberate to suit the sort of overblown tone of the story.
I think that it is. I think that it is too, but it's something that I can't help but wonder about. And that's, for me, more a result of the time in which it was made, where, you know, I don't know that you could ask Lynn Varley and she'd be able to tell you definitively that she would have done it one way or another, where the stuff that we have now, maybe there would have been a lot of the same kinds of intentionally didactic, you know, use. And you know, I think there is a time and a place for everything. And it is something that to me has a certain amount of charm. I cannot help but wonder what choices she would make with the much more evolved version of these tools. But I agree with you that, you know, it is a product of its time, and time travel doesn't exist. I'm sorry, Back to the Future fans, it just doesn't exist. So I don't know that even if she could get in a theoretical time machine and go back to 2001 with, you know, a Wacom tablet and the Photoshop Creative Cloud that we have now, that she would have done much terribly differently. You know, when you look at the base art that Frank Miller put down, the style of coloring that she went with is very much in concert with the very different style of base art that Frank Miller put on this as compared to Dark Knight Returns.
Right, and it is very different, partly because Miller's inking himself in this as opposed to being inked by Klaus Janson, but also, again, because of he'd spent all that time working on Sin City and 300, and everybody's art evolves and changes over time. And one of the most notable things about Miller's art as it's developed over time is how much more expressionist and, I don't want to say cartoony, but exaggerated. How much it is incredibly caricatured and exaggerated, even more so now, but even 14 years ago, much more so than it was in the 80s when he was doing stuff like Dark Knight, which was itself, you know, regarded as fairly stylized and caricature-like at the time. This is even more so. This is much more like later era Sin City artwork.
Yeah, and well, that's exactly what many people said. That was their criticism. They pulled right out. They're like, what the hell? This isn't Dark Knight Returns. This is Sin City. What the crap? You got your Batman in my Sin City. What's wrong with you? How dare you? And where do you get off? There are these little Millerisms I think that you get coming from the Sin City direction. He's coming off of all of the Sin City stuff and a lot of how to best characterize this in a way that isn't derogatory to anybody. Sometimes bluntly misogynistic tone that he takes, just little bits of it that get sprinkled in that, you know, do kind of bug me. You know, the bit with Superman and Wonder Woman where in caption boxes she's saying, "Where's the man who stole my Amazon heart? Where's the hero who threw me to the ground and took me as his rightful prize?" Which, you know, she's an Amazon. She's been, depending on which of the seven different Wonder Woman backstories he thinks she ascribes to in the Dark Knight universe. You know, maybe it is part of the big, you know, savage, fantasy universe kind of Wonder Woman, you know, warriors who took each other in the dirt. Kind of tone that he was going for, but there was, you know, there was another bit where one of the people who escaped from Kandor says, "Professor Palmer, I want you inside me." And okay, you know,
it's made a joke out of, but yeah, it's well, and his designs as well. I mean, you know, one of the things I was less thrilled with in this certainly was a lot of the designs. Overall, even things like the Bat Boys are, you know, not a great design. But then you also get, Carrie's outfit and, you know, the way Wonder Woman's depicted and all these things. And you're just like, yeah, this is real, you know, like really dialing up the sort of femme fatale, you know, sort of very sexist depiction of women that you get in stuff like Sin City, which in Sin City is kind of, I mean, it's not great, but
these are women who actually have hips.
Right. Well,
these are women who actually have hips. To an extent, I have to stick up to an extent, I want it on the record, to an extent, for some of the representation of body types in Sin City, in that not everybody is an anorexic or bulimic, and those are real conditions, and, I have a great deal of sympathy for people who suffer from them, but, you know, looking at the anorexic or bulimic body type as an ideal, these are women who have full bust lines, full-sized hips, thighs that actually meet in the middle, like many, many, many human thighs actually do.
Right, but they also have waists that you can put your hand around.
That is the problem. Well, there's this element, this element, but there's that one nagging little bit that bothers me. And the same thing is true here, where, I like so many different parts of it, but there are those little elements thrown in around the edges that make it a little bit problematic is the hip term. And, I'm sorry to be part of the crowd using it, but there are those bits that bother me. They're not as frequent or obscene as I think a lot of people made them out to be. Again, right. A lot of people reading, hit piece articles on the internet that have exclusively screen captures of seven panels from it and not the other 240 pages of material that actually make up the whole work. It is problematic. It is not, the best and does not reflect on him the best, but it's not all over this thing in the way that I think a lot of people have alleged it. Were there other things that you found people to very unjustly level against this as criticisms that just aren't there in the pages or that you think is wrongheaded?
I think the main thing I took away from this was that certainly, as I said, the notes on the coloring, you know, people's criticism of the coloring, I think was very, very unjust. The story is, well, the plot, I should say, is actually, I think, smarter than many people gave it credit for at the time. I mean, the satire is
radically so.
The satire is incredibly heavy-handed, you know, and quite sort of tiring after a while, to be honest.
It's as much of a blunt instrument as his line work.
I mean, you know, the satire in Dark Knight Returns, I think the difference it felt like to me was Dark Knight Returns felt like a satire on the 80s, on the time in which it was produced. Dark Knight Strikes Again felt like a satire of the future, or of a future that could happen, as you mentioned, you know, like, this may not be exactly how it goes, but here are some of the things we're heading towards. And he did get some of those right, but the satire on them felt weirdly disconnected because it wasn't a satire of anything that at the time was recognizable. And even, you know, sort of reading it now, but thinking back in retrospect, and of course, you know, living now in the future, effectively, as we do, a lot of it just didn't quite hit, and it did feel quite tiring after a while. But the plot, stuff with Candor, the Dick Grayson thing, you know, all of these, the questions involvement, all of these things were actually pretty smart. And, you know, in terms of just pure plot, it was as good as any Miller superhero work, I would say.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that, again, you know, looking at it with the benefit of now living in the future, there are so many things that read so much, I would say, contextually better than they did in 2001. Okay, yes. But in general, things that, because of the jarring difference in style, both in storytelling and art, people weren't even, they weren't going to absorb that because they'd been put off by something wholly disconnected from the actual plot that they were reading. The other elements of it are something that they were, it'd sound terribly fanboyish and fawning to Miller, which I don't want to come off as being, to say, well, they just didn't appreciate him. He was ahead of his time.
Right. It's very easy to say, frankly, people didn't realize the genius they were looking at, but there is an extent of that.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that there's some cynical superhero satire stuff in here that people didn't cite as having been influenced by, but that in the 14 intervening years, I can definitely see people have, I mean, maybe they just accidentally did some sorts of similar things in looking at the, you know, the use of superheroes as an element of the government's peacekeeping force and, you know, holding something over their heads. Something that I've seen explored by not just the big two publishers, but people with, you know, indie books and creator owned books. There are elements that I've seen mined that Miller used in Dark Knight Strikes Again that I think people would never publicly commit to having been influenced by, but it just it feels a bit too convenient, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, there are those things that, well, it's safe to just look like it you know, these ideas sprang forth from my forehead like Athena, the forehead of Zeus. then say, well, you know, I was reading Frank Miller's much maligned Dark Knight sequel, and I just figured, well, you know.
And actually, it gave me an idea, yeah. So tell me more of the things that you like about it, because we've delved into the criticisms. I think we've tried to be pretty fair, but what are the things that you actively like about the book?
A big piece of it is really the media, multimedia criticism stuff that which I think put off a lot of people, and they were like, what the hell is who are these girls in tights and who cares about any of this stuff? I like that a lot. I like it a whole lot. And it's something that when I read it at the time, I didn't get why so many of my friends were like, why aren't we watching Batman punch people? And I said, because I don't think it says Batman punches people for 3 issues on the cover. It was something that I, you know, for whatever his motivation was, it was something that I found interesting. And as I was kind of going with his panel layout and design at the kind of rapid pace that I think helps a reading of Dark Knight Strikes Again. It's something that worked for me. It just plain worked. The kind of quality television star-ifying of, you know, the new pundits, not being the people in suits in a studio in Washington, D.C., but being the people that, you know, that some dude wants to, you know, get home from his job and watch, you know, wear skimpy clothes or no clothes at all and give him the news or give him their opinion of the day. Stuff that, regardless of how some of it did or did not bear out, was something that I found more interesting and maybe not as cynical as I think a lot of people took it to be at the time and still, you know, try to classify it as. Yeah, there is plenty of cynicism all over this thing that I saw happening even then. You know, the guests that were coming on talk shows, it was more about the kind of cult of personality than intellectualism. That's something that, as a devoted fan of Transmetropolitan, for example, really I found very interesting and the sort of thing that kind of terrified me. And I hoped against hope. Well, no, we're not headed toward that sort of reality, are we? It turns out that's we live there now. There is no middle class, and it's a bunch of people getting millions and millions of people to watch them say ableist and racist things. And those are our new kings and queens, everyone. Yes, we live in that dystopia now. So I thought, oh, this is a great thing to hope against hope doesn't happen. Now I'm getting depressed. something that I liked about it at the time, and I like about it a bit more is that, yeah, he said, okay, you're going to do Kingdom Come and you're going to play with all the toys in the toy box. I'm going to play with all the toys in the toy box that I'm interested in.
And in my way.
But in my way, and in ways that are not going to be the way that you want me to. And, you know, suddenly I'm going to pull this person out of here and this person out of here, and I'm going to reduce the Riddler to a cannibalistic zombie with one word balloon and you don't even see him. I love that he took so strident an approach with, guess what, kids? I'm going to pull all your toys out and I'm going to do horrible, horrible things to them that you're not going to like. Not just for the sake of doing the horrible things, but hey, you know, these are the toys that I have to tell the story with, and a lot of horrible things are happening. So sorry, kids. I really like that. I as much affection as I have for many of these characters, and as out of character as I think a lot of the complaints were that, well, I don't know that Ray Palmer would do that. Well, he was imprisoned in a Petri dish for however long.
Right.
Being in a Petri dish changes a man.
If this was a different podcast, I think that'd be the title of the episode.
Yeah. there's that disregard for what people's expectations were, you know, that he had to represent this character a certain way or a certain other way. Just throwing that out the window with no regard whatsoever for people's feelings. That kind of ballsiness is something that I feel like people who get to play with these characters, the situation is very different. If you're someone who's just writing the ongoing Spider-Man comic or Batman or whatever, and restrictions that you're within. But I wonder if many modern creators, given the free rein of, look, you're going to have this size of an audience on you, and you can do whatever you want with any of this stuff. Just give us 3 issues of it and let's sell a bunch of it. I wonder if they would have that same kind of without care approach to just...
Right. If they would be as iconoclastic as Miller.
Yeah, I wonder. I wonder if they wouldn't, give in to their own sentimentality in some cases, where sentimentality has its place, and it's why he was bringing these characters back into the story, but he threw that right out the window when it came time to what he was actually doing with them.
Yeah. Well, and sentimentality is, you know, if there is a plague on the American mainstream comics industry for the last like 40 years, sentimentality has been it.
Yeah. That's something that I don't think he gets enough credit for, is that specific kind of decision making. fine, I'm doing this, and I'm sure that someone's going to complain, well, technically, John Jones, would have still probably been able to do blah, 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 blah,
and doesn't talk like Ben Grimm.
Yeah. I love that he kind of looks like and kind of talks like Ben Grimm all of a sudden.
It's basically Ben Grimm.
It basically is Ben Grimm. It's, you look at him and, he sounds in your head nothing like the Martian Manhunter from, the Justice League cartoon, for example.
No.
He doesn't have that, that kind of sonorous, thing. It's that, look, man.
No, he sounds like he's from Yancey Street. I mean, it is, that can't be an accident. Yeah. That's got to be deliberate, that he basically wanted to use Ben Grimm, but couldn't because it's the DCU. So who can we get?
or almost, I wanted to think that he didn't feel like he necessarily needed that exact character, but he knew that he was going to use the Martian Manhunter. And I almost feel like he does some things intentionally to piss people off because, well, that's not how you write the Martian Manhunter. I almost want to say that he consciously made that choice because he's like, well, this is going to be the Martian Manhunter and this is going to happen and that's going to piss people off. But you know what would piss people off more is if I just kind of wrote him like Ben Grimm. And then immediately people would say, well, that's not the Martian Manhunter. That's just, I'm sorry. But not A, you cannot do that to the Martian Manhunter. And B, it's not even the Martian Manhunter. So technically I've found you guilty, Mr. Miller. You're not allowed to make comic books anymore. I, the fan, have put you on trial and, it almost feels.
And found you wanting.
Yeah, it almost feels like that kind of kickback, pushback against fandom dictating what a creator is and is not allowed to do. Not just doing the one step of it, but going forcefully right into the fan's face of going, guess what? This is going to seem very ill-fitting, and there's a very good reason for that. I want to make you very uncomfortable with this and not happy about this. Not just for the sake of pissing people off, but I can appreciate that. And
although that is also a big part of it, I think, especially
yeah.
with Miller.
Yeah, I think so.
I think he enjoys pissing people off.
I do. And to that same extent, I find myself in this bizarre conflict with this thing where some of the things that, like I mentioned earlier, the way that it ends were just kind of ends. It feels like he ends it in an uncomfortable way. Not like, it's not the kind of, I like to call it the French ending of something like The Killing Joke, where it's open to many interpretations and that sort of thing, even though the author has a very clear, specific intent behind what mm-hmm. actually happens. It's not one of those kinds of endings, but it's something that doesn't have the kind of satisfying splash page kind of, the end fiend at the end of a movie kind of a thing.
Right. Well, like the first book did as
well. Yeah, it's more uncomfortable than the ending of the first book. And I kind of admire that for the same reason of the way that he treats the toys he takes out of everybody else's toy boxes, in that he just kind of doesn't care, that it doesn't feel like, well, that's how it's supposed to end. I feel like he designed that last page to make people assume there was going to be something when they turn the next page. And then they go, and there is what?
Yeah. All it is it? The end pages.
What?
Yeah.
Yeah. That again is something that I like about it. Defying expectation, not just for the sake of defying expectation, but because he knows it is actively going to piss somebody off, is something that, sentimentality reigns supreme, and down to the way that he ends it, people finish reading that and go, oh, well, they're just going to release another one in 2 years. And, we'll have Dark Knight 5 a few years from now, and it took another 14 years to put another volume of this thing out. And the original title of the third volume being Superman and Batman versus the Master Race, and the way that they're promoting it seeming to, yeah, there's definitely, the Batman side of things is still a prominent part of it, but there's a much more prominent role for the Superman side of things. Again, feels like, hey, you kids, you love your Dark Knight Returns. You want some more Dark Knight? Guess what? you're not getting it. And, you know, I don't want to spoil things that DC themselves have put, you know, press releases out and press information about. But I like that the things that I like most about Dark Knight Strikes Again, which really can be summed up as the abject rejection of sentimentality of, you know what, the story's going to happen and you're probably not going to be happy about some of the stuff that happens in it. And I don't care. That he is doing that again with a different combination of creators yet again, is something that I have a great deal of admiration for. You know, for whatever reasons people want to ascribe, you know, as to why he wants to do another volume of this thing. I think that aspect of it is still so sorely missed in mainstream comics, that I cannot help but have an overall positive, association with and memory of Dark Knight Strikes Again.
Awesome. All right, Moises, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
I'm on Twitter at Moises Chiu, MoisesChiu. All the podcasts that I host and produce, you can find at esn.fm. A number of them are coming back off of hiatus with a vengeance. If you liked our talking about coloring, one of the somewhat recent episodes of Giant Size that we did is all about the world of coloring, and features excerpts of interviews with Neil Adams, Walt Simonson, Elizabeth Breitweiser, who people might know from basically anything Ed Brubaker does now.
excellent work on Velvet.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Gorgeous work on Velvet. If you're not reading Velvet and, you know, you want to take a comic book recommendation, read Velvet. For the love of God, read Velvet. It's better than the new Bond movie. I do the signature show on the network, Electric Shadow. I've been posting some archived interviews and some brand new stuff. Electric Shadow and Giant Size are the biggest homes for where my heart in content creation are. And by the time this goes up, I don't think it'll be live yet. But if you follow me on social media and keep up with the stuff that I do, I am kickstarting my first professional comics project, a creator owned thing that I've been working on for a very long time, with art by comics legend Mr. Val Merrick, and we're very excited about it.
Awesome. Moises Strikes Again.
God. Yeah, my middle school creative notebooks strike again, to some extent.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. I hope you enjoyed it, and if you did, please check out my comics, books, and music. Go to anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. Please also consider rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes. It's the best way to spread the word about the show and is very much appreciated. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find more information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. So I could actually imagine casual readers, and I say that without meaning to sound pejorative, but I could imagine those sort of, you know, casual comic readers loving this book because it is very iconoclastic. And that is what a lot of the mainstream audience likes about books like this and Watchmen and, you know, Dark Knight Returns and even maybe his Sin City work. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But certainly the superhero works, they love that they are iconoclastic. It's why so many non-comics readers think Man of Steel is a great movie. You know, I know some of these people and they love Man of Steel because as far as they're concerned, it is iconoclastic. And it's like they kind of regard grim and gritty approaches to superheroes still as novel because these haven't yet become saturated within the mainstream. So these people, they haven't sort of progressed through the grim and gritty stage like most of us regular comics readers have, you know? Why does Green Arrow have Nazi throwing stars? I do not understand that.
I think he hung on to them from the mutant gang in the first series. That was the only thing I could come up with.
Oh, I suppose.
Maybe. That's the only thing I can think of. Man, I cannot believe
weird seeing this, you know, famously left-wing character using swastika-shaped shuriken. It was like, what?
Hey, you know, you got to scrounge for what you can get.
It was so weird reading this, you know, sort of in retrospect, having not read it at the time. But you're right that, like, the one thing that really comes across from it is that Miller... I mean, you know, because he's fortunate enough. Well, I say not fortunate. He's worked his way into a position where he neither cares nor has to care. You know,
he's got his audience. He's not begging for it or clamoring for it. You know, he's written his ticket, and it's a matter of what he's going to do with it. Now.
Well, and he has a huge audience outside of regular mainstream comic readers as well. That's the thing. I've said this before to people. Like, I know I have met many, many people who have no interest, real interest in comics as a sort of, you know, the industry that we think of it. They're interested in the form, but they have no interest in reading monthly regular superhero comics or even most regular indie comics, but they read Frank Miller. As far as they're concerned, Frank Miller is the epitome of, you know, of great comics, and they will read anything that Miller puts out, but nothing else. If it's not by Miller, basically, they're not interested because they're like, well, that's just crap. But this is Frank Miller. It's extraordinary.
They'll show up, you know, even if it's something like Holy Terror, that to me is not great in really much of any respect for me. And aside from the politics, it doesn't work for me as just comics. Even to an extent, the way that All-Star Batman and Robin does, where I, you know, you can like, hate, love, or leave the characterizations, at the very least, it, you know, what they published of it, is readable.
Right. It's a well put together book,
but there are people who will just, you know, okay, Frank Miller's name's on it, I'll show up. You know, they reprint Hard-Boiled, they're going to go grab Hard-Boiled. That kind of devotion is the reason that, and this is something that I'd forgotten, but I remembered it was maligned for at the time, you know, was on the back of each was, after 15 years, the long wait for the sequel to The Dark Knight Returns is over. Frank Miller and Lynn Varley, the multi-award winning team responsible for the original series, have united once again to set an astonishing new standard in comic book entertainment. They can get away with that.
Right.
Like, the devotion is so deep that they can get away with something that tremendously egotistical of, we're going to redefine comics for a new generation.
That's exactly how I felt when I was watching the comedy series The Day to Day, the Chris Morris series over
here. Chris Morris.
Yeah, which was hilarious. I can't watch it now. I can't watch it because it was so hilarious at the time, because it was so outrageous and so like, oh, well, this is so absurd and so kind of over the top. And now it's just the news. Now it is just, that's what the news is like. And I can't watch it. It's depressing.
Oh God, that and Brass Eye. Chris Morris is an unparalleled, terrifying genius of comedy who, if you're an American like me and you didn't see any of it as it broadcast, you might just find lots and lots of it on YouTube because it was never put on DVD.
Well, it was, but only over here.
And Chris may not care about people watching it for free.
I doubt that he would. All right, but that's another show entirely.